Network, proudly presents the Jay Slade Show. With your host, CyberGolf.com's own Jay Clemmer, and co-starring a galaxy of the golf and sports world's greatest names as special guests. Yo, 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 this is your main man, DJ Q, telling you to put your hands together for your friend and mine, Jay Clemmer.
All right, thank you, DJ Q, for bringing us back into the show in style. Hey, everybody, good to talk to you all again. I am, indeed, Jay Flemmer of the Golf News Net Radio Network, and you're listening to Jay's Plays. So glad to have everybody aboard for another episode of the show. It's been a great week in golf. We're edging closer to the Masters, and we're going to be discussing amateur golf, and we'll be talking a little bit about Tiger Woods and the various travails he's had with his injuries. Jay's Plays is brought to you by JB's Best. You've tried the rest, now try the best hot sauce in creation. It's spicy, it's bold, it's flavorful. It's JB's. When it says JB's, it's the best. All right, everybody, so we're going to have Dr. Russ LaFrance, our sports doctor that comes on the show to come and talk a little bit about Tiger Woods' injuries. Doogie the Doc, as he's known, because he's a dead ringer for Doogie Howser. And he's very famous throughout the sports world, having worked at the famous Kettering Hospital out in UCLA, taking care of the Bruins and the Dodgers and the Kings and all the rest of the California athletes before he moved east with his family. And right now, we're going to go to our first guest on the show. We've had him on once before. He's one of the great amateur golfers in the country, a very well-traveled golfer. If you've dreamed about playing there, he's probably been there. And he's played in all of the great amateur tournaments, not just here but abroad. And he's got a great idea that he's helping move forward called the Session Cup, which you may have heard of. Please give a warm Jay's Plays welcome back to Alan Fidel. Alan, welcome back.
Thank you, Jay. Good to be here.
How has your winter been? Have you been playing a lot?
I've been playing a lot, yeah. My winter's been pretty good, but we've had a lot of rain down here in Florida, so it finally stopped, and we're starting to get out there and have some fun.
Where have your travels taken you in the last few months to play?
You know, in the last few months, I have played Concession, and I have played Seminole, and I have played Medalist and a couple others, but I've been pretty much right here.
Well, you're going to get a chance to do a lot of traveling this year because the amateur calendar looks absolutely fabulous. Between the U.S. Amateur visiting storied Oakland Hills, the men's four ball coming to mighty Wingfoot, and the men's mid-amateur going to visit outside of Pittsburgh, Stonewall Links. Three great golf courses, three great tournaments. Let's pick them off one at a time. Talk to us a little bit about Oakland Hills and the pressure of the U.S. amateur tournament.
Well, I mean, Oakland Hills is, you know, one of the best golf courses in the country. And last time, I think Ricky Barnes was the winner at Oakland Hills. And I think it's going to be somebody who we're going to see on television, let's put it that way, because it takes all facets of the game to master that venue.
Absolutely, particularly the green complexes with those terrific wild contours, and especially set up for a U.S. amateur with a lot of long, thick rough if you get too far off. Getting up and down from around those greens is very difficult. You're like walking around a minefield of unexploded double bogeys. But the other thing that I liked very much about Oakland Hills was the routing. It's not out and back, and it's not two loops of nine. The holes are like a Gordian knot. They wind and interweave with each other. You know, especially that great par 5 12th hole that slithers up through the middle of the golf course up the hill. When I got out there, you know, Oakland Hills, Alan, was a course I had never studied before it came time for the PGA in 2008. So I had zero expectations, and it exceeded my expectations in every single avenue. What about your thoughts about playing Oakland Hills? What makes that golf course so great?
Well, I think the green complexes, you know, are the real treasure of the golf course. I mean, there's some of the most sophisticated and complicated green complexes. I've ever seen, and they've always made them fast. I mean, they were fast back in the 60s and 70s. So people have been contending with that golf course for, you know, like that for a long time, and I think Mr. Hogan might have said it best, you know. His respect for Oak Grove was fabulous.
Well, he fired one of the great finishing rounds in U.S. Open history with that 67 that he closed with in 1951. People disagree about what the exact wording of the quote about this monster to its knees was. Dan Jenkins is there, and he has a much different interpretation. But I'm waiting, and I think that this is going to prove to be the precursor. I'm waiting for the U.S. Open to return to Oakland Hills. They are constantly talking about how they need a good Midwestern venue, and it seems like they bounce around a lot, you know. First, they tried Olympia Fields. That didn't work. Now they're going to go try Erin Hills to see if that works. You know, they haven't had a lot of luck, you know, outside of the New York area and California. You know, the flyover states have been more difficult. We haven't seen them return to Colorado yet. But it seems like Oakland Hills screams to be the perfect U.S. Open venue. You know, it seems like the kind of place that, like Oakmont, or Wingfoot, if there were ever an emergency and a U.S. Open venue had to be scrapped and one replaced on short notice, that they could hold it at Oakland Hills.
Yeah, I think that's the case, and I think there's some other golf courses in the Midwest that scream for it too, and maybe they're not in the right markets or what have you. But I mean, Inverness is a good example where I've been a member forever. One of the best golf courses I've ever played. And I think what's great about venues like that is it gives some of these players that haven't had an opportunity to see what, you know, maybe Mr. Hogan and Mr. Nelson contended with, is like. And they haven't really been, they've been changed, but not dramatically. Inverness was changed in the 70s. A little bit, and Oak Hill, I think, in the 70s a little bit. But, you know, a few holes here and a few holes there. But they basically play a lot like they were intended to.
You know, it's funny you should mention Inverness, because one of my favorite stories in all of golf comes from the U.S. Open at Inverness in 1978, the infamous or famous or humorous or ridiculous Lon Hinkle story.
Yeah, no, I was there. I remember that whole thing. There were some other things that happened at that Open, too. That's the Open that Bobby Clampett was marking.
Escorted off.
Yeah. It was an interesting Open, you know.
Tell us about what Clampett did that got him sort of, you know, removed from the premises.
Well, I mean, he was a marker, and he at one point he started hitting the tee shots off of his knees, and the USJ people were out there instantaneously and took him off, and they didn't think it was becoming of a player, especially a player that was really not in the competition, to be doing something like that. And I tend to agree with them. I think they made the right call, but it was news at the time, just like the Hinkle tree was news at the time. And it made it a very interesting Open championship. And I might add, in 79, I believe, when Hale Irwin won, I think he was plus one for the tournament. Or maybe even, I don't think he was under par. And, you know, for four U.S. Opens up to that point at Inverness, nobody had ever broken par.
Inverness is a difficult golf course. And I think that one of the reasons why not just Lon Hinkle, but most of the rest of the field took his shortcut was to gain a stroke on that big evil par five at number eight by hitting into the 17th fairway and turning a three-shot hole into a drive and a short iron. Here's one of my favorite stories about that, though. Okay, it was no less a personage than Mike Strantz, the famous golf course architect who now sadly has passed away of cancer. He was the guy who was supposed to plant the Hinkle tree, and he kept trying to tell everybody else, you have it in the wrong place. You have it in the wrong place. You're not blocking off the entrance. And they wouldn't listen to him. And sure enough, when Hinkle got there, he saw that they'd missed it. They'd left about a 6 foot wide gap, and he went right through that gap into the 8th fairway again. Into the 17th fairway again.
Yeah, it did Chi-Chi, you know. In fact, a lot of people said Chi-Chi did it first.
Well, now, Chi-Chi, you bring up another perfect point, okay? Chi-Chi and my icon and idol and dear friend, Marino Parasenzo, will go down in history as one of the best 1-2 combos in a post-match interview. When Marino asked Chi-Chi, how did you manage to hit that tee shot? You're a short little guy, so high into the air. And Chi-Chi said, well, I didn't have any long tees, but I teed the ball up on a pencil. And Marino said, well, okay. Then how did you get the pencil to get the golf ball to balance on it? And Chi-Chi said, I took a divot tool, and I made a depression in the top of the pencil, and I balanced the ball on that. And Marino asked him, well, why did you use a divot tool? And Chi-Chi looked at him cross-eyed and said, because they don't allow knives and Puerto Ricans together in Ohio. The place fell apart in laughter. So moving on to the next great golf course that we're going to see the amateurs play, Wingfoot, one of my absolute favorites, the graveyard of champions. It's funny when you look at the list of U.S. Open losers, people that never won a title at Wingfoot. It's a pantheon of the greatest names, not Tiger Woods, not Jack Nicklaus, not Seve Ballesteros, not Tom Watson, not Greg Norman, not Phil Mickelson. What is it about Wingfoot that is so devastating?
Well, I think it's just hard, you know. I mean, the first time I played it was in the 70s, and I actually went to work at one point for Craig Harmon, and the Harmon family, I mean, their reverence for Wingfoot is probably second to none, and I was afraid of it after that just from hearing the stories from them, you know. But it's just a fabulous golf course. It's very well done. It's very well designed, and I think for a Midwesterner as kind of a country hick, you know, playing in a major market is a big deal.
You know, it is the Yankee Stadium of golf courses as well in that regard, with all of its storied history and with it being an indelible part of the fabric of New York society.
It should be.
You know, now, here, you could definitely make that an index of American society if you were to go through the history books there. And there really is something special about walking into that grill room and looking at those wall panels and seeing all the names of the great champions up there and all the pictures of its epic past. But here's the greatest secret about Wingfoot. Happily, I get to play it a good amount. The members keep it playable at all times outside of big tournaments. Okay, you don't have to play out of 5-inch rough, and you don't have to play on greens that are speeds of 14. And you know what? If you kick the ball reasonably straight, it's not that bad. Okay, how many water hazards are there on Wingfoot West? Zero.
Yeah.
So you're not going to see a lot of penalties. There's no out of bounds, you know. Even if you're, hitting the ball somewhat sideways, you're still going to be able to find it and hit it again. You know, you're not going to get a lost ball at Wingfoot. You're not getting an OB penalty at Wingfoot. I mean, unless you really do something stupid. And there's no water, with the exception of on the east course, there's the pond on the fourth hole. But, you know, that's one hazard in 72 holes and zero on the U.S. Open golf course. So it's not so bad for bogey golfers. And if you play the right set of tees, you find the distance somewhat manageable. When you get to tournament conditions, though, it's a completely different story. It is long. It is bumpy. The greens, when ratcheted up to high speeds, have so much contour. And the green surrounds as well. You know, I would almost like to see the USGA contemplate going to the East course one year, because when they had the U.S. Amateur at Wingfoot, the East course played just 0.2 strokes harder, easier than the West course did. And it's not a significant amount.
No, it's I've played them both. I've only played in one Anderson because it always conflicted with the our state amateur where I live. And I got to tell you, it was a treat. Both courses were absolutely a treat.
Now, the four ball is being played there, and the Anderson is also a four ball tournament. So for our listeners who don't get a chance to play four ball or team golf or anything of that sort, explain to them how four ball works and what are the strategies involved.
Well, I mean, you know, the way, I might not be the one that should be given the strategies after I haven't made either of the first two four balls. But anyway, two players basically play a better ball. And whatever the better ball is on the hole, that's the hole, that's the score that they post. Strategies, you know, if you have a long hitter and a straight hitter, I mean, you can imagine what the strategies might be, but it's amazing how much that kind of golf is about the way the two people, you know, get along and the way the two people, you know, think. But it's a great way to play, and I don't think we play. I mean, we play some four ball here. Probably most of our matches at our clubs are four ball matches, two guys against two guys, and it's a fun format.
And then, what will be the format of the Anderson, and what will be the format of the four ball USGA event?
Well, they're both similar in that you qualify over 36 holes. You'll play, you know, if you're lucky enough to get into the event, they'll have a medal play qualifier over 2 days between the East Course and the West Course, and the low 64, probably 63 in last year's winners. I'm not even sure about that, but I'm guessing it's the low 63 teams in last year's winners get bracketed into match play.
Right, and then they'll play matches for the remainder of the days. 36 holes a day, two matches, one in the morning, one in the afternoon.
Exactly.
So, all right, well, we're up against a short break, everybody, but we will be right back after this. Alan Fidel appearing on the Jay's Play Show on the Golf News Radio Network. I am Jay Funnel. We will be right back.
That bump music means we're going to have to take a short break. Don't go away. We'll be back at the second half of the show in just a minute.
This is your main man, DJ Q, and you're listening to Jay's Place on the Golf News Net Radio Network.